Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Bridget Shade. Bridget Shade's stories have appeared in Clapboard House, Compass Rose, The Oral Tradition, and Voices from the Attic. She is an English lecturer at the University of Pittsburgh and Carlo University, and is the fiction editor at Weave magazine. She will be reading from her manuscript, Cactus People. Welcome to Prosody, Bridget.
Hi, Ellen. Thanks so much.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit for us?
Okay. The first story I'm going to read is called The Purpose of Posthumous Photography. It is a story about a woman who is dying of cancer. And the conflict is that her husband's family has this tradition of photographing the body at the funeral, which she's fine with if she can wear her hat, which she has affectionately named Annie. So I'm going to pick up in the middle here. He thinks he's shielding me from the truth, concealing his feelings by hiding in the back room, sitting on the edge of the bed where our girl used to sleep, talking on the telephone behind closed doors. But I know. I hold my hand over the cordless and listen in on his daily conversations with the links in the prayer chain. At least she knows Jesus, the biddies tell him. Don't know how a body gets through this life without knowing Jesus. Ed clears his throat and says, soon, God willing, she'll be with him. Her suffering'll be no more. It's in our sights now, sisters, the coming of the blessed end. And all the biddies say, amen. Not Christian of me, I suppose, referring to the old blue hairs as biddies. At least they have hair. They're handy with the green rice casserole, and I know they love the Lord, but it makes me angry sometimes to be half their age and sitting on the death end of the receiver. Ed, on the other hand, seems to take comfort in their concern. He hangs up the phone and shuffles into the living room, shakes his head and sighs heavy, plays at being annoyed. But Ed is a terrible actor. He'll miss those women when I'm gone. After all this time, he's finally found a flock of loving hens to mother him. But they don't know Ed like I do. When he's not fielding calls from elderly parishioners, he's stroking that ferret our boy dropped off with his laundry load 3 years ago. Unnatural creature's Ed's pet now. He holds it by the throat and works his way down, pumping his fist the length of its spine, squeezing it like it's a tube of toothpaste. I tell him the thing can't possibly be enjoying that treatment, and that its eyeballs are likely to come squirting out of its head if he keeps on the way he's going. So then he gives it up for a while and paces the upstairs hall, runs down the steps to the landing by the front door, pivots, peels out in his tube socks before sliding down the second set in a panic, like he's in a big rush to catch the rinse cycle. But I know, it's so he can sneak into the garage and puff on a cigarette every other minute. You think I can't hear you? I call down to him. I know what you're up to. If you have to smoke, do it in here. Don't sneak around like a silly child. But he won't smoke indoors. Our girl's allergic. Sometimes I think he forgets she's been down there straddling the Carolinas since college. Shacked up now with that sorry excuse, Carl. Last time they visited, I asked point blank about a wedding date. Our girl escaped to the toilet while that fool man of hers rattled off some kind of plumber speak. It's called a dry fit, ma'am. Got to be certain the pipes are properly fitted before you go gluing them together. I asked him just where he thought he'd find such miracle glue as to hold water forever without springing a few leaks, particularly living the way they do on an island. That was a year ago, and forget the sacrament of marriage. What I wanted was a wedding while I was still alive. It pains me to think of our girl walking down the aisle, fixating on the empty seat in the first pew. She and Carl don't come around much anymore, especially now she's growing our first grandbaby inside her. But Ed's hoping. Every time a car door shuts or opens, he bolts to the window like a prisoner of war, like a soldier who's been left behind. I can't blame him for that. These days I look more like a whoopee cushion than a woman, flaccid from the neck up, bloated in the middle, splayed out on this hospital bed because it's supposed to make me more comfortable. My insides bulge and shift. My hair, except for a few optimistic sprigs sticking out at the temples, is all but incinerated. My pants are too tight and my sweaters are too baggy. I wear Ed's shapeless white T-shirts and spit up on them hourly. I can't eat or sleep, and there's a considerable amount of moaning. Nothing about this life is comfortable, and you can forget about appealing. But I have time. 2 months at least, Doctor said. There's still some things I need to do. Been meaning to fish those toothpaste lids from the sink drain for years, and I always planned on finishing the afghan I started knitting for our girl the summer she went off to school. I used to worry I'd slip getting out of the tub and break my neck before I had a chance to burn the contents of the shoebox under the bed, and now there's nothing stopping me. No garden to tend, no Sunday school lessons to prepare, no lines to stand in at the First National or Food Lion. Should make the most of it and rescue the old pictures from my closet. Separate the memories for the children. Me with the boy in his Little League uniform. Me with the girl in her cap and gown. Leastwise pluck my chin hairs. Feature that. My head's like the parched lawn come late July. No growth where you want it and weeds poking out where you don't. And hell, but it hurts to laugh. And most days it takes all my strength just to lie in our living room. Write in the diary. Swallow the painkillers so I can roll over and reach to rub Annie's ribbon between my fingers. Argue with Ed. Watch the sun streaming carelessly through the window panes.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Bridget Shade, reading from her manuscript, Cactus People. I'm glad you started out with that piece, because when I was reading it, I was thinking about a couple things. One was Sherwood Anderson and the idea of these kind of characteristics that help us see both the beautiful and the grotesque in characters, and this hat that this woman's wearing and how that becomes this kind of vehicle about kind of everything she's feeling and everything that's happening to her. And I was just wondering if you could just talk about that a little bit, like where the hat came from, how that helped you develop the character.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this story, she wears the hat instead of the wigs. She doesn't like the wigs. And the hat has become very worn and tattered. But the hat's been there with her throughout all of it, and it's never shuddered at the sight of her. So she's very attached to the hat. And I think irrationally, as humans, we often attach ourselves to these small, insignificant things because we're unable to deal with the larger picture.
Sure.
So, yes, it did actually start with the hat.
Did it?
The story began with the hat, yes.
And I was also thinking the title of the piece as well. It's Posthumous Photography.
Mm-hmm.
And what it made me start thinking about were issues of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
These things that you have, these secrets you wish you could have, but somehow they've been made public, things like illness or something's happened in your family, these vulnerabilities, and how those then become both precious and wounds at the same time,
mm-hmm.
because everybody focuses on them. And I was just wondering if privacy is something you kind of think about in terms of your character, or are there like things that they wish the world didn't know and that's what interests you about them? Or
yes, that is interesting. I think part of the reason that this character wants to wear the hat is because she wants to be known at the end of her life. She wants to be known for who she truly is. As the story goes on, you kind of find out more of her secrets,
mm-hmm.
Which she reveals kind of in a state of delirium, and it causes some additional tension between her and her husband. But yes, I think the contradictions in people, the things that we show versus the things that we feel, is definitely something that interests me. And I think a lot of my stories deal with very common issues. I think there are no new ideas, but I try to find ways to express them in a
right.
new way, in a different way.
The other thing I wanted to talk about with this story is the voice.
Mm-hmm.
One, you read it really well. I mean, you brought her to life in this way that is, as now listeners can tell, quite different from your own voice.
Yes.
And you know, there are writers at times who try to write in voices, and you know they aren't voices that they know well, that are authentic to them. They feel kind of manufactured in that way. That's not true with this. This is a voice I can tell you know really well. So I was just wondering if you could talk about the voice a little bit.
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. the best answer that I have is that it's the voice that I hear. And I don't always hear it when I'm writing a story. Sometimes I hear it in my own voice. Sometimes I hear it in the voice of a man. But for some reason, when I wrote this story, this is the voice that I heard. And I've tried reading it straight with my own voice, and it just comes out wrong. It does. I can't feel it.
Well, there's something in the descriptions that it's tied to the tone of the voice. It's not just the words. Because when I read this story, I could hear a voice that I knew was authentically the character. So that's interesting. So as you're sitting down to write, does the voice come first and then the story after? Or do you start to kind of write the story and then it sounds a little weird, you start to hear voices, but you start to hear the voice?
Yes. Sometimes it begins with an image like the hat. Sometimes it begins with the voice. I think when I saw the hat in my head, then I heard the voice. And it, that does sound a little creepy, I guess, hearing the voice. But I mean, that's I can hear her talking, and
sure,
that's how it comes out.
I think it's what side of the equation you're on. As a writer, I'm sure there are writers out there right now going, oh, that's great when that happens, when the voice comes through and you can just, in essence, kind of start transcribing and crafting from there versus, you know, readers might go, So if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Bridget Shade. Bridget, would you read some more?
Sure. The next piece I'm going to read is from a story called The Machinist's Son. And this is a story about a boy whose mother has been taken away by the police. And it's been several weeks she's been gone. He doesn't know why. He doesn't know where she is. He comes home from school one day, finds his father is loading the refrigerator with boxes of government cheese. And additionally, he's begun to call him Fred, but Fred is not his name. So I'm going to pick up in the middle when the boy's uncle has come to visit and he's taking him fishing to the carp derby, hopefully win some money. Friday afternoon, and every spot on Ackman's gravel lot was occupied. Fred had never seen so many red pickups in one place. He thought to count them and write down the number to show his dad, but he didn't want to put into words what the paper was for, so he decided not to ask Uncle Cliff if he kept a notepad in the glove box the way his mother did. They pulled over onto the grass next to Route 978. Uncle Cliff straightened his hat in the mirror and said, "Just try and give me a ticket." Fred felt as if the eggs were scrambling in his stomach. He never wanted to see another police car. Not again. Ever. "Let's not take any chances," is what he wanted to say. Instead, he kept quiet and wrung his hands until finally Uncle Cliff said, "Easy, pal. I was only kidding. It's perfectly legal to park here." "Sure, I know that," Fred said, and popped out of the van like a slice of toast. He carried the rods, still in two pieces, toward the sound of 100 reels turning. Uncle Cliff paid the entrance fee, $10 apiece, then trailed behind with a styrofoam cooler in tow. They squeezed into a spot beneath a weeping willow, where there was a ledge barely wide enough for one person to stand, let alone two, but it was the only green space left. Despite the size of the crowd, it was quiet as church. Uncle Cliff dropped the cooler, spit sideways into the water, and said, "Do me a favor. Don't fall in." Fred had no intention of getting close enough to fall in. He couldn't believe how the lake had changed. Still shaped like a tennis court, but polluted now with downed trees, sinking docks, and what appeared to be an arm bone. Last season's leaves did the dead man's float. Cattails pushed out from green film, flies zipped past cans of crushed beer like broken-down buses on an expressway. The water was brown and slick with something like a rainbow that didn't quite mix. He remembered how it had looked last summer when he was still 10 and not Fred. How everything from that time seemed shinier and clean. Now there were just three ducks, orange mushrooms, and tall grass everywhere that made his legs itch. Even the willows seemed cruel, dropping their braids into the water, wiggling like worms to tease the fish. Fred assembled the rods while his uncle kneaded the bait. They worked in silence, and Fred squinted to make the water sparkle in the sun. He could see better when his eyes were slits, and it occurred to him that on top of everything else, he probably needed glasses. Few clouds to shade the lake, and the carp floated close to the surface, sunning themselves. Every now and again, one would leap into the air and belly flop back into the water, leaving a ripple in its wake. In other places, the water seemed to hiccup like fireworks only the fish could see. Beneath the oily surface, shadows of bluegills swam in circles, chasing around as if they were trapped, searching for a crack in the ceiling. Sick of eating bugs and duck potatoes, The hook, Fred thought, must have looked like a picnic. Here, Uncle Cliff said, and handed Fred a ball of yellow bait.
What is it?
Ancient Chinese secret.
But
your dad changed his mind. Take it. I feel lucky today. Fred knew his father never changed his mind, but he grabbed the sticky cheese and molded it onto his hook anyway. The pot was up to 2,000 bucks, and casting his line, he aimed for a sunny spot. On the way home, the van smelled of bacon and burnt wood. Fred wished they didn't live so close to the lake so he could take his time enjoying the sight of that envelope sliding back and forth on the dash. Uncle Cliff said they'd split the money, even if it was Fred who'd plucked the winning carp from the water. 25 pounds of bottom-feeding victory! Wait till Dad sees, he said, marveling at the thickness of the wad.
I don't know, Uncle Cliff said. Maybe we should keep this between us. Wouldn't want to jinx it. But you're just like your mother, always jumping the gun. If she'd have come to me and asked for help, things might have been different.
Fred wasn't prepared for that kind of talk. It was the first time anyone in his family had mentioned her, or a gun. He coughed a bit, pretended to be too distracted by choking to have heard. With one hand on the wheel, Uncle Cliff smacked Fred's back. Listen, kid, he said. Loose lips sink ships. Let's wait and see what happens tomorrow. We win again, we'll tell your dad all about it. Scout's honor.
Uncle Cliff drew an X over his heart, and Fred tilted his head out the window. A warm wind blew back his hair, and when he smoothed his hands through the sweaty mop, he caught a whiff of government cheese. He wiped his palms on his jeans and tiny grits of yellow rubbed off.
Uncle Cliff pulled into the driveway, tucked the envelope into his pocket, and said, "Whatever you do, don't breathe a word about the bait." Then he climbed out of the van and winked at the windshield on his way inside. Fred sat for a moment longer. He thought about how quiet the lake was when he reeled in that fish. It was like living in slow motion, and every move he made controlled what happened next. He had the touch, and most of all, the golden dough ball. Last year, they'd cooked a potion of cornmeal and grape jelly, but nothing had worked like the cheese. Uncle Cliff was right. All you had to do was say the words out loud, and before you knew it, every angler in the county would be crying poor, rushing to load the refrigerators with cardboard boxes. Telling anyone this soon would be a mistake. Fred clapped his hands against his thighs once more, then dusted away the evidence. Even with the window rolled down, the heat was suffocating. Still, he sat straight. He studied the side mirror, furrowing his brow, forcing a crack in the middle of his forehead until he could see a family resemblance. He understood then what his father must have meant when he said Stevie was a little boy's name, one his mother had picked out of a list in some baby book because she liked the way it looked on paper. She'd had her say, her time, Fred thought, but now it was a time for men.
If you've just tuned in, I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Bridget Shade, reading from her manuscript, Cactus People. So Bridget, one of the things I'm interested in is why you're interested in stories. What is it about stories that you like that has caused you to become a writer of them?
I think I've always been the kind of person to go to a restaurant and watch people and wonder what their lives are like and invent backstories for them. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of years as a reporter writing stories about people, of course, in a nonfiction way. But I always felt very privileged to be able to take someone's story and share it with a larger audience. And I think writing short stories, fictional short stories, gives me the same sense of privilege. Because although they're fictional characters, they become real to me.
Sure. I'm curious about it because in particular lately on some blogs on, you know, out in the great internet world, there's been a lot of talk about there's been a lot of talk about literature in general lately because it's shifting so much. And stories have always seemed to be kind of the form that everybody's debating whether they're in fashion or out of fashion or about to come back into fashion or not. I think novels, people always expect, well, they'll always be novels, and poets assume they'll always be poems. Sometimes there's a debate about short and long form and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, you know, that's part of my curiosity, is what draws people to write stories. You know, I've written some stories myself. And for me, at least initially, it was about the self-contained world. Mm-hmm. As well. Mm-hmm. You know, a novel initially seemed to me way too scary, mm-hmm. because you had to, it seemed like a world that was going to be bigger than maybe what my writing could be. Mm-hmm. And so did you always start? I mean, you said you were a reporter, so obviously you've mm-hmm. always been a writer. But was story really the first form you just really kind of gravitated to?
Yes. Yes. I guess I have an idea for a novel, but haven't ever really pursued that, because I always have story ideas that I want to get to first.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would tend to disagree with those who would write on the blogs.
the blog.
That, you know, short fiction is or is not in. I think it's for as interested as people seem to be in technology and the quick access to information, I would think that short stories would be absolutely at the top of the list.
It's the way we communicate with each other, mm-hmm. too, right? We mm-hmm. don't sit and tell our whole life novel to somebody. We sit right. and tell stories all the time. Yeah, I think, you know, some of that also has to do with the commercial aspect of things and what mm-hmm. sells and doesn't sell. But mm-hmm. I find it really interesting when this conversation flares up again. First off, I guess it should matter, but I mean, it's not like that you can only write novels or poems and then stories have to justify themselves or not. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yes. Yes. So many wonderful writers were predominantly short story writers. Eudora Welty and Flannery O'Connor, although they did write novels, it's not what they're known for.
Yeah. How about your collection? Can you talk a little bit about that? How long you've been working on it? Kind of how much is in the collection? How many stories? How it's taken shape? That kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm. I finished my MFA in the spring from Carleton University, the manuscript is, as you mentioned, called Cactus People, which is the last story in the book. It's sort of the male counterpart of the main character from The Purpose of Posthumous Photography. It's also pretty heavy on the dialect, really heavy, actually. And I think the reason I wanted to call it that is because I see everyone in the book as cactus people, which is very weird. We don't live anywhere near cactuses. We don't live in the desert, at least not here in Pittsburgh anyway, where I live. But what happens in Cactus People is the man has just lost his job, and his wife is in the habit of decorating their front yard with all of these crazy seasonal type things, as well as things that don't seem to make any sense. So the most recent contribution to their front yard ornamentation are these aluminum cactuses. And he gets very angry and begins to take everything from the house, all of her kitschy things, and he sets them on fire in the front yard. And he uses the cactuses to kind of jam all of it together. And she comes home and says, you know, what are you doing? And he says he just doesn't want this anymore. You know, this is ruining his life. In his mind, it's not the fact that he's lost his job. It's her fault that she keeps cramming the house with all this stuff.
That's interesting, because I've noticed in your stories that there is this I don't know exactly how to put it. The way that there are objects in your stories, it's as if they give your character shape, but mm-hmm. they don't give them comfort.
Hmm.
So like the hat, even there's some objects in the machinist's son. There's always these things that have weight in their world, but they're mm-hmm. not things that necessarily I would call mementos or that give them great comfort. They're almost obsessive objects at times, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about it that way. I think what interests me most is the idea of having an object that you think defines you. I had a grandfather who would carry a briefcase that said, life was meant to be lived and not watched. And then he would get very angry and say I was a better door than a window if I stood between him and the TV. So I think these, you know, these contradictions that we have, we think we define ourselves by this material thing, but in fact, we're something else entirely. This cognitive dissonance that goes on is, I guess, the premise of Cactus People.
Yeah. Do you have one more short piece that you could read for us?
Sure.
Great.
Okay. This is the end of The Machinist's Son. The boy has won a lot of money in the carp derby. He can't tell his dad he's won all of this money because he would have to tell him he's been taking the cheese, and the cheese is not meant to be used for bait. So he's decided to use the money to buy a boat, which he believes his dad has always wanted. He's bought the boat from a man at a gas station, but he's told the man at the gas station that he has all of this money. So this is the end of The Machinist's Son. The house was dark when he pushed through the door. He slid the bags onto the floor and opened the living room drapes. His father sat in the rocker, facing the blank television. Fred opened his mouth to tell him about the money, that the boat barely cost half of what he'd won, and summer wasn't even over yet. He wanted to explain that things were going to be okay, but the breathing coming from the chair sounded heavy and unfamiliar. Dad?
Hmm.
What you doing in the dark? Fred made a move for the groceries. The carpeting squished beneath his feet, and he slipped, tripped over a lamp cord, and banged his knee into the plant stand. On the floor, he noticed the bat. There was hair, and dark red smeared across the fat part. His knees sunk into a warm pool. Then he saw something slumped in a heap of sun beneath the window. He recognized the hands, the smell of machine grease, but his head was wrong, shaped funny.
"Come away from there," his father said.
Fred crawled to the foot of the rocker, dragging his wet knees slowly behind him. He pressed down on what felt like a pebble. He squeezed it into his palm and heard the familiar sound of gravel shifting under the weight of tires in the driveway. For a moment, he thought, "There it is." "Daddy," he said, "I bought us a boat." His father said nothing. Fred opened his hand and saw a tooth. His body filled with air. He could only feel on the edges, numb tingles of fear and disbelief. His father rocked back and forth and said,
"Man breaks into my house. I got a right to defend it. It's my job. That's what I told them when I called."
Fred thought his father sounded like a recording, like he'd been saying it all day. "It's my job."
"Who?" Fred said. "Who did you call?" "Knock his damn teeth out if I have to."
Back and forth, his father rocked, hands folded in his lap. "Knock his damn teeth out." Red and blue lights flickered through the screen, and Fred buried his face into his father's work pants. He made himself very small as he counted and committed to memory every stain, stitch, and pleat.
Thanks for coming to Prosody, Bridget.
Thank you, Ellen.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.